Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our first guest today is Stan Temple, back once again with us. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. He's also a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Always great to have him come by and talk about phenology, how the changes in seasons affect reproduction cycles for plants and animals. So how white-tailed deer time their mating season so fawns are born in the spring during better weather, or maybe how the flowers bloom at certain times of the year to attract birds or insects for pollination. So, and of course, the Aldo Leopold Foundation puts out a phenology calendar, and we want to talk about that with him as well. And I hope you'll join in with your wildlife questions as we move along today. You can join in at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Stan Temple, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's good to be back and talk about the changing seasons. Oh, winter is coming in a week.
When is the official winter?
Well, meteorological winter starts December 1st. So in terms of climate, that's when we mark it. So winter is December, January, and February. Spring is March, April, and May, and so on.
So phenology, there's a long history of, maybe talk again about what it is and its history a little bit, because I think that's interesting.
Well, I think people have probably been keeping track of the seasons and timing their own seasonal activities for millennia. But the science of phenology, where people actually started to keep accurate records and make predictions about when things would happen in future years, probably dates back to the 19th century. And during that time, keeping phenological records, observing the plants and animals around you and making notes of when special events like blooming of flowers or the arrival of migrating birds became a hobby. And it was quite popular. And Aldo Leopold, growing up in the late 19th century, was exposed to that at school and at home. And he became a keeper of phenological records literally throughout his life, literally until the day he died. Larry, one of his last written words in his notebook was a phenological observation of lilacs. But it's become now, in the 21st century, a very popular citizen science activity with, once again, lots of people finding that it's interesting to track seasonal events, and perhaps the fact that the climate is changing so rapidly has motivated a lot of people to pay more attention to how the seasonal events are shifting with the climate.
Well, and I think that's it's really important in helping us understand these changes a bit. If you look at, I noticed in this year's phenology calendar, the date for the first freeze-up of Lake Mendota in Madison, and those records have been kept for how long, 100 years maybe?
Oh, they go all the way back to Burge's time when limnology was a brand new science. But yeah, people have been keeping those type of records for a long time, and certainly for some flowering plants over in the Orient, keeping track of cherry blossoms goes back sometimes over 1,000 years.
Wow.
So, you know, it's something that people are fascinated by, and certainly in our current situation where the climate is changing rapidly, you may not really notice that there's a couple of tenths of a degree change in the average temperature, but it sure catches your notice, you know, when the lilac bushes in the backyard start blooming weeks earlier than they did in previous times. So phenology becomes an indicator that many people have sort of latched onto as a way of tracking climate change.
And you mentioned lilacs, and I was thinking about all the phone calls we've had this fall about people calling in saying, my lilacs are suddenly blooming here in the fall.
Yeah, well, that's a phenological sort of anomaly that happens when we have unusual weather conditions, where we get cold snaps and warm snaps happening in quick succession, which we did this fall, and certain spring flowering plants like lilacs and spireas and several other woody shrubs literally get confused because the cues that they normally use to time their blossoming aren't lining up with the way the weather is unfolding.
And I want to ask you about animals as well and how they may be reacting, but I want to get first into the Elder Leopold Foundation Phenology Calendar, which I always enjoy every year. What's the theme of the calendar this year?
Well, we've been doing this now for a decade, and every year there's a general theme, and I write an introductory essay outlining the theme, and then for every month sort of elaborate on some species that are illustrating the theme. And this year, the theme is growing up wild. In other words, how plants and animals make sure that their offspring have the best chances of survival. And that, of course, means often months or even in some cases years ahead of time planning, so to speak, for when that birth or germination is going to happen. And so it's a very complicated story to understand how plants and animals reproduce in such a way that their offspring are born or germinate at the best possible time for their survival.
It's amazing. I think you may have said this to me, and I'm sure Scott Craven has at one time or another, that we go in Wisconsin from the lowest population level of white-tailed deer to the highest level in about a three-week time in May.
Yeah, that's right, when those fawns are born. And, of course, they are born in spring, but that requires, because of the white-tailed deer's long gestation period, that requires that the does get pregnant in the fall. Hence, the rut, the mating season for white-tailed deer is occurring, of course, pretty much right now. And that ensures that those fawns are going to be born at the time of year when their chances of survival are going to be best.
Stan Temple, our guest, we're talking with him about the seasons and phenology and the Elder Leopold Foundation Phenology Calendar. You may have a question about phenology. Maybe you just have a general question about our birds or our other animals. Stan's ready to answer those as well, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. And there are differences, I guess, between, if you look at the state, there are differences between the southern and northern areas of the state. Is that somehow taken into consideration in the phenology calendar?
Well, when we produce the phenology calendar, we do have a little explanation that the dates that we use on the calendar are the dates for when things happen in south central Wisconsin. But because Wisconsin, of course, has several degrees of latitude, the further north you go, the later things happen. And Wisconsin from east to west also has a gradient. So we give you a little equation, if you will, that lets you kind of predict how much adjustment you would have to make in the date that we give you in order to get the correct date for your location.
Yeah.
And this is well known. I mean, we all know that, you know, the seasons don't unfold exactly at the same time at different latitudes and east to west as well.
And I think your November 2022 calendar has sandhill cranes featured.
Yes.
And the calendar outlines how the season affects sandhill cranes. They migrate differently from other birds.
Well, they do. They're like many large birds that have offspring that grow slowly. the young birds stay close with the parents through the fall migration and into the wintering area, and don't really part company with their parents until the following spring. So this is important because the young birds during that first migration learn things from their parents. They learn where the staging areas are. They learn where the important stopovers are on migration. And that's what's happening right now, actually, in Wisconsin. On the Wisconsin River, right behind Aldo Leopold's shack, we have about 10,000 sandhill cranes that are staging for migration and putting on quite a show for people who've reserved a field trip with me to see these birds.
Oh, that's got to be just an unbelievable experience to hear 10,000 sandhill cranes.
It is a spectacle, and something that, of course, Aldo Leopold couldn't have predicted back in the 1930s when sandhill cranes were almost gone from the upper Midwest.
We should take some calls. Steve in Ladysmith has a question, I believe. Steve, thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Hey, thank you. Just wondering, I saw a brood of turkeys this year during bow season that looked awfully small. What's the latest you've seen as far as a brood of turkeys being born late in the season?
And that's pretty far north, too, Ladysmith. So,
yeah, this is something that happens occasionally and is somewhat predictable. If a female turkey loses her first clutch of eggs, usually to a predator, in some cases, not every case, but in some cases, they will sort of recycle and lay another clutch of eggs. And that could result in a brood of young turkeys that are perhaps even a month to 6 weeks later in their development than young turkeys that are hatching at the normal time. So presumably the brood that you saw are the result of a female that lost her clutch of eggs and was able to recycle and lay a late clutch that, amazing, she brought them off, apparently. Looks like they're still hanging in there.
Yeah, and you wonder if they're going to be able to hang in right through the winter. And I imagine that depends on what happens in the winter.
It does.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Stan Temple, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, Senior Fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, our guest. Mackenzie Crummy, our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at phenology today, what's going on in the outdoors with our guest, Stan Temple, who is a senior fellow in the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and, of course, an emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Callers online, there's still a line open for you at 800-642-1234, or if you'd like, you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Ivy, I believe, in Evansville.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if Dr. Temple could speak to the fall migration of woodcocks in southern Wisconsin and near the border with Illinois. I saw one, I believe, about 3 weeks or so ago, just out of the corner of my eye, but it looked like a woodcock landing in a field where I see them display a lot in the spring. And I did a little research, but I thought maybe he could enlighten me some more. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, the migration of woodcock is not that dissimilar from quite a few other birds in that they learn the right general time of year to migrate based on photo period, based on day length, which of course is the same from year to year. But we all know that the climate and weather are not the same from year to year. So even though a bird like the woodcock may be primed to take off on migration earlier in the fall, if the weather is mild, as it has been, this is amazingly mild this fall, some of the birds will hang around and not actually leave until they get the cold snap that sends them on their way. And that's pretty much true of a lot of birds. We just spoke about sandhill cranes, and the same thing for them. They will hang out on the Wisconsin River and in the evening and go out in the recently harvested cornfields during the day. And they will remain in Wisconsin. Basically, even though they're primed for migration, they'll stay here until one of two things happens. Either the corn gets buried in snow and they can't find anything to eat, or the water freezes and their nocturnal roosts are no longer safe. So for most migratory species, they're primed for migration, but then there's an immediate weather or meteorological cue that sends them on their way.
Thanks so much for that question. Let's go to Susan in Escanaba, Michigan. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question about are we seeing a change in bear hibernation? And I can take my answer off the phone.
All right.
Thanks for being.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you, Susan. Bear hibernation. Well, maybe just talk about that. They're biologically adapted to seasonal changes, are they not?
Yeah, bears have a particular need because they hibernate over the winter to begin the preparations for winter and hibernation early. So they get their cues to start fattening up again from declining day lengths in the fall. And assuming that they get a head start and have had enough time to fatten up, they're ready to go into hibernation at the time when the weather generally has sort of turned against them. And at least for our black bears, you know, the males and females and young bears sort of go into hibernation at different times. And that probably has to do with their need to put on extra fat during the winter. The females, of course, need to be in especially good condition because they're going to be giving birth and lactating and raising those young.
Yeah, raising those young. Oh, I think we lost Stan. I'm not hearing him. Maybe the call dropped. I tell you what, Stan Temple, we'll get him back. Stan Temple, our guest, a professor emeritus in the Department of Forests and Wildlife Ecology at the UW. And we have open lines anyway, so you can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. And the email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And we'll try to get Stan back here in just a second or two. And I'll just remind you that coming up at 11:45, maybe earlier if we can't get Stan back.
I'm back.
Oh, you're back. Good. All right. Stan, we were talking bear hibernation, and so go ahead with that, your comments.
Yeah, and as I was saying before we got cut off there, that the males and females and young bears have different demands over the winter, and especially for the females, they have to really prepare and fatten up because they're going to be giving birth during the winter period and initially, of course, lactating to feed their cubs. So preparations for hibernation are particularly demanding for female bears.
And Stan, I'm going to mention this again later, but we're getting so many calls already from people wanting to know where can they get the calendar.
Yeah.
Let's get that information out, and we'll repeat it again. But for now, how do people get the copy of that calendar?
Good. Well, the Aldo Leopold Foundation produces this now very popular. We sell thousands and thousands of copies every year. And they can be ordered for $15 at the Leopold Foundation's website, which is simply aldoleopold.org. And the first banner that you see on the website is the place for you to order the calendar.
Perfect timing, in time for the holiday gift giving and for your own personal use. And believe me, the calendar this year is absolutely beautiful. We'll talk some more about that. But Carol in Caledonia, Minnesota is up with a comment or question. Carol, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Just an observation that I was hoping to get a comment on. This year in southeastern Minnesota and also in the La Crosse, Wisconsin area, perhaps other areas as well, everybody's lilacs were in full bloom this fall, you know, which is very unfortunate because that means they're not going to have any blooms in the spring. But just like to get a comment on that.
Hmm.
Right. We commented on that earlier in the show, but it is a phenomenon that is somewhat expected when we have an unusual fall season like we have this year, where you get an especially warm spell followed by a dramatic cold snap, followed by yet another warm spell. And this really confuses some of the early spring flowering woody plants like lilacs and spireas and so on. The cues that they normally use to blossom in the spring, they're getting now in the fall. And you're right that it's unusual, but on a year like this, it's sort of expected that it'll happen.
Yeah, it's kind of too bad because there aren't going to be as many flowering lilacs in the spring, which we always, I think, at least I certainly do look forward to. Let's take, we could take another call here in a minute, but let's talk some more about the calendar. The, one of the, mentions in the calendar has to do with hibernating animals like bull snakes as well. How do bull snakes figure out when to hibernate?
Well, for cold-blooded animals, like snakes and reptiles and amphibians, there is a day length component to it, but it's mostly temperature driven for them. But the theme for this year is reproduction. And for snakes, for example, where there are not that many of them on the landscape, if they don't get together for mating at the right time of year, it could mean that a female would not be able to reproduce. And they have a very special trick that they use. Female snakes and several other female reptiles store the sperm from their most recent mating and can use that to fertilize their eggs, often for a year or more in the future, in case they don't actually encounter a male in time.
Wow. That is fascinating. Man, oh, man. Dawn from Sussex called but couldn't stay with us. She's a duck hunter and said the last couple of years haven't been great for our duck hunting. Is there something going on that is reducing the duck population in Wisconsin?
Well, we all know that there's been a big drought.
Yeah.
And, of course, droughts are tough on waterfowl because it shrinks the wetland habitat that they need for reproduction. And that is the explanation for the fluctuations often that we see in waterfowl populations. It's weather, but it's not our fall weather. It's the weather during the summer breeding season further north.
John Matthews from Bosque Belle called, couldn't stay with us. He wants to know where the Aldo Leopold Center is located, and is it possible to take tours?
The Aldo Leopold Center is located on the shores of the Wisconsin River up in Sauk County near Baraboo. And if you go to the website, aldoleopold.org, you can get directions. And, yes, we do have tours during most of the year. We're closed during the winter, except for special events like our crane viewing field trips and other special events. But come spring and summer, you're welcome to visit, have a look at the Leopold Shack that's so famous because of the Sand County Almanac, and visit the Aldo Leopold Center, which is a beautiful building, which for several years was the greenest building in the world.
Yeah, it's a wonderful building. It's just a wonderful experience for anybody who visits that, just to see the shack and then to see this wonderful center and do a little touring through that area. It's absolutely beautiful. You can join in, too, by the way. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. There's a beautiful photo of a prairie smoke wildflower in the calendar. Why did you include that one?
Well, we picked an early blooming spring wildflower, which prairie smoke is, to illustrate something that's important in phenology, and that is getting a plant and its pollinators in sync with one another. And for the very early blooming wildflowers, like prairie smoke, they are incredibly important for overwintering queen bumblebees. Bumblebees are having a tough time of it. They're declining like many bees. But for a queen bumblebee that's made it over the winter, as soon as she can get active in the spring, she wants to find a plant that produces not only some nectar, but a lot of pollen. The pollen is actually an important nutrient. And if you know anything about prairie smoke, they have these long stamens that are loaded with pollen so that when a bumblebee lands on them, bumblebee really gets a good load of pollen. But it's important, of course, that in this case, the prairie smoke and the bumblebees be in sync with one another. If they get out of sync with one another because they're responding differently to climate change, it could be tough on the female bumblebees not being able to find plants like prairie smoke that provide a lot of pollen in the spring.
Matt in Rudolph, I believe, has a comment that relates to this a bit, I believe. Matt, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, it sounds like you're talking a little bit about my question, I think. I keep domesticated honeybees, and then we also have many wild bees that we sort of support on our property. But I'm wondering, I know how the honeybees react when the weather gets warmer, even though, you know, fall has kind of come on. You know, they're feeding off their reserves of food and using that up. But I'm wondering what happens to the native bees. Like, are they leaving their places of hibernation? Do they have stores of food? I mean, some of them probably do and some don't. How is this climate situation affecting the native bee populations is my question.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's probably not helping them at all because any of the bees, especially native bumblebees that emerge fairly early, they need to be in sync with flowers that provide not only nectar but pollen for them. And if they get out of sync, which there's evidence in some cases that bees and their pollinating plants are getting out of sync with one another, this can lead to problems. Either the plant doesn't get pollinated or the bee that would do the pollination is deprived of the food that it needs early in the season after a long winter with food supplies depleted.
Thank you very much, Matt. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. You have, you don't always have two photos of the same type of species, but you do this time around. And January and December both have owls.
Yeah, and because there are some unusual things happening, the January photograph, a really beautiful photograph.
Oh, man, it's gorgeous.
Of a great horned owl in a tree that's covered with hoarfrost. But great horned owls already, even now, are starting the preliminaries for breeding. And they've started defending their territories and defending against other owls. But they'll begin laying their eggs very early in the year, followed by a long incubation period and a long period of the young developing. And the reason they start so early, which seems kind of dumb, why would they start nesting when there's snow on the ground and sub-freezing temperatures? But it's because they want those young birds to be leaving the nest so that those young owlets, when they fledge, have that spring flush of rabbits and squirrels and other prey that they can feed on. And then, you know, we talk at the other end, at December, we've got a beautiful picture of a barred owl.
Yeah.
And something is happening right now that many people who have owls in their neighborhood will probably be aware of, and that there's a lot of hooting going on. And that's because young birds of the year are being kicked out of their parents' territory. And when they start wandering around the landscape, they trespass on other owls' territories and get chased away. So there's a great deal of noise going on in the owl communities as these young birds kind of get bounced from territory to territory until they finally find a place of their own. But it's happening just at this time of year when the parents are reestablishing their territories and beginning the preparations for breeding.
Miriam in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. This is sort of a strange question. I do know there is a type of redwood called the Dawn Redwood, which can grow in the Milwaukee area. It's not so cold that it will kill them. I'm wondering if, due to global warming, could other types of redwoods or even sequoias be raised in this area now? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off radio. Thank you.
Of course, I'm a wildlife expert, but I would guess that our climate is going to have to shift quite a bit before species like that are going to be able to easily adapt to our climate. But there are species a little closer by that are doing much better, things like sycamore trees, for example, and beech trees that in the past had sort of reached the limits of where they could thrive in southeastern Wisconsin, are now actually moving north and being able to deal with our milder climate. So seeing sycamore trees and beech trees in places where they never occurred before is probably being facilitated by our milder climate.
Miriam, thank you so much. Steve in Green Bay will turn to you. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. I got a question for your guest. Deer hunting 3 days ago, sitting in the woods, a grouse comes down right in front of me and parades just like a turkey would, dropped his wings, stomped his little feet, put his tail up, and then I saw the female grouse come out, but it didn't drum, just paraded like a turkey would. I've never seen this before, and I'm just curious as to why would a turkey be strutting or a grouse be strutting, A, and B, why is he doing it this time of year? Is there a reason for that, or am I just hallucinating?
No, there's a reason for it, and it's kind of an interesting one, that for many birds, not just grouse, but for many birds, the males in particular in the fall have this sort of surge of testosterone, and it leads them to, in the case of songbirds, start singing. In the case of grouse, start doing some of their displays. It's not going to amount to anything because the females aren't receptive. But this little fall peak in testosterone goes away as soon as the cold weather sets in. So your grouse is going to give up his displaying pretty soon. But it's all fueled by hormones and a very brief phenomenon that you were lucky enough to see.
Yeah, that's really cool, Steve. Thank you so much. Peter from Aquantico emailed to ask about blue jay migration. Peter says he's heard sometimes the birds stick around and sometimes they go south. Any research or information on blue jays?
Yeah, blue jays are a good example of a species that can shift its strategy from being a migrant to overwintering. And a lot of that has to do with how much food is going to be available over the winter. And as anyone who had an oak tree on their property knows, this year, we had a huge mass crop, a huge bumper crop of acorns, just phenomenal, which meant that for blue jays that love acorns, that means that there's a reliable overwinter food supply that they can continue to use. And as a result, a lot of the birds will simply overwinter. They're a big enough bird that they can handle the Wisconsin winter as long as they have a good food supply.
Yeah, very, very good crop of nuts this year.
No kidding.
Alyssa from Spring Green emailed to ask about the bird illness that was affecting the eastern states. anything about the illness, and did it reach Wisconsin?
Well, that was an unusual event. It's quite normal for birds to suffer sort of zoonotics and epidemics of diseases in the summer. It's spread by mosquitoes and flies and other types of vectors. But this year, something unusual did happen in that the mortality didn't have an obvious cause. They looked at all the usual suspects, all of the usual viruses and bacteria that normally cause these summertime die-offs, and nothing really popped up. So I haven't heard that there's been a proper diagnosis, but the guess was that it may be some new virus. We do know about new viruses, don't we?
Mm.
That it was a new virus, sort of like the COVID virus that the wildlife disease specialists just weren't anticipating was going to cause mortality. But no, it did not reach Wisconsin in any significant way. We still had birds dying of West Nile virus and other types of more common avian diseases, but not this unusual case.
And Cheryl emailed to ask about snowy owls. She lives in Clark County and saw one yesterday.
Yeah.
She doesn't usually see snowy owls until it gets really cold outside.
Well, snowy owls, of course, are coming from the Arctic, and they are motivated to head south by a shortage of food as the cycles, especially of lemmings, go through this four-year cycle when lemmings are at their low. Snowy owls will head south, and they will continue heading south until they find a place that has a sufficient abundance of small rodents for them to feed on. So your owl presumably has come from the Arctic and just hasn't found a good spot to settle until maybe it settled in your area because you had a good population of mice for it to feed on.
And they seem to be less afraid of humans than maybe they should be.
Well, coming from the Arctic, they don't have a lot of experience with people. And for animals like that don't have prior experience with people, they're often sort of uncharacteristically tame and very sort of trusting of people. And snowy owls can be that way, definitely. You can pull your car right up under a phone pole that one is sitting on top of, and they just look at you.
I've got a beautiful, large photo of a snowy owl on a barn roof, an old red barn roof, and that snowy owl against a blue the blue sky background. It's a beautiful, beautiful shot. Well, speaking of beautiful shots, there are a lot of beautiful photos in your phenology calendar. Once again this year, you've done a great job with it. Stan, and tell us again, how do we obtain copies?
Well, thanks, Larry. Yeah, a lot of Wisconsin photographers contribute those beautiful photographs to the calendar, which can be obtained for $15 from the Aldo Leopold Foundation. If you go to the website, aldoleopold.org, the first thing you see is a banner that invites you to buy some copies. And if you order now, plenty of time for them to arrive in time for Christmas presents, which I know a lot of people do because they're so popular. I think last year we sold almost 8,000 copies.
Oh, man, that's wonderful. And I'm betting that you're going to get a lot of work on that website, eldoleopold.org, coming up in the next few days. Stan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry, and I'll send you a calendar in the mail.
Oh, you're a good man. Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, Senior Fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. And that's one of those calendars that sits up on my wall every year in one or the other of my offices or at home. Well, coming up, switching gears a little bit and turning our attention to the sky, stargazing with Paul Kinzer. That next. I'm Larry Mueller.